Hello and welcome to Catholic Answers Live. Thanks for being here with us on this Tuesday afternoon or evening or Wednesday morning, depending on where you are. As always, we're so grateful that you're here with us, and I think we've got a very, very fine and interesting show for you. The second hour, Tim Staples will be here, and we're going to do open forum. You can ask Tim whatever you want, and I imagine there will be some folks after this first hour who will want to ask about the Pope's recent motu proprio on the traditional Latin Mass and where and when that can be celebrated and under what conditions. And that's what we're going to talk about this hour. And we're going to talk about it with Bishop Thomas Papraki, the Bishop of Springfield, Illinois. Bishop Papraki, thank you very much for being here with us.
You're welcome. It's good to be with you.
So I note that you did something that I don't believe any other bishop in the United States has done. At least I have not seen the reporting if they have. And that is you issued a formal dispensation to some parishes in your diocese to just continue what they were doing as far as the celebration of the Latin Mass. Can you just explain to me what you did and why you did it that way?
Well, I issued a dispensation because that's a formal canonical decree, and I was being asked by priests in my diocese who were celebrating Mass in the extraordinary form in their parish churches. There were two of them, one in Quincy and one in Springfield, and a third parish was doing a Saturday morning Mass. And so these priests, being more traditional, are also very concerned about being obedient. They did not want to be disobedient to the Holy Father if he said that these Masses should not be celebrated in parochial churches. And some bishops I saw were simply saying they were giving permission for these Masses to continue. But I was kind of wondering what's the canonical basis for doing that. And it would seem to me, if I just was issuing a statement saying, well, go ahead and say the Mass, even the priests themselves would wonder, well, am I then just disobeying the motu proprio, or on what basis do I have authority to do this? So I thought, for their own peace of mind, I would issue a dispensation, which a diocesan bishop can do according to Canon 87 of the Code of Canon Law when it involves disciplinary matters and not matters that are constitutive. Well, what that means is, what's constitutive? Constitutive would be something like the Eucharist itself being celebrated with bread and wine. So I couldn't issue a dispensation that says, you know what, you don't have any wine available, you can use grape juice instead or something else. I can't do that. But in a disciplinary matter, and I would argue that the time and place of a Mass is a disciplinary matter, especially in this case, the restriction that says the Mass according to the 1962 Missal is not to be celebrated in parochial churches, that's actually in parentheses. So it doesn't seem to me to be even a main thrust of this. And a dispensation is canonically considered to be a weakening or an exception of the law. So I've got 129 parishes in my diocese, and I've given a dispensation for three of the churches. So it's not a complete abrogation of the law, but it's just being sensitive to the pastoral needs in these particular circumstances.
So a bishop has the power given to him in canon law and the traditions of the church then to dispense from disciplines. So is this the same power, for example, like a bishop that might say, St. Patrick's Day falls on a Friday in Lent, and you can eat meat on St. Patrick's Day? Is that the same power?
Yes, it is. So it is that same power that a bishop can dispense his diocese from the obligation to abstain from meat on a Friday in Lent, if that happens to be March 17th, St. Patrick's Day. Also, it's something that in American civil law we're not too familiar with, but we do actually use it quite a bit in canon law. For example, most of us probably know a Catholic that's in a mixed marriage. Between a Catholic and a non-Catholic, which is technically forbidden by church law. But those are dispensations that are granted pretty routinely. So dispensation in the church and in the canonical system is something that's done actually quite frequently.
So this is something that other bishops could, I mean, you're a canon lawyer yourself, and so you took a canonist approach to this, but other bishops could imitate you if they desire.
Yes, I chose to take a canonical approach because that's my training, and I wanted to do this in a way that was correct, technically correct, And so I've distributed copies of my decree to other canonists, and I told them I'm not asserting any copyright over that, and if they want to cut and paste it, they can go ahead and do that.
So you just cross out Paprocki and put Bob Smith or whoever it is. Okay, well, so that, I think that, that could be very helpful, because people are nervous, and certainly the folks who are attached to the traditional Latin Mass, and I realize I'm using shorthand to speak about it there, but are anxious and nervous. But I'm looking at the media sources that are available, and there's several media sources that are keeping a list of what bishops across the United States have done. And it's really the vast majority who have said, I'm studying the motu proprio and I'll get back to you when I've studied it more. Most have not done anything. So it may be that this would be, for those bishops, also a way to consider moving forward in their diocese.
Well, yes, I think in terms of the consultation, you may have bishops who are not canon lawyers and maybe don't feel as confident as I did to just go ahead. I wrote that decree myself and consulted with the canon lawyers in my diocese, but I think other bishops may be saying, if they're not canon lawyers, maybe asking their advisors what they think and what's their proper approach. So I think they want to do this in a way that's correct also, but not rushing into it. And I think one of the difficulties that is the position that bishops have been placed in with this is not being given advance notice of the motu proprio and then being told in the decree itself that this is effective immediately upon publication in the Osservatore Romano. Normally, there's about a 30-day period when some kind of a new law is issued and before it takes effect, so that there would be time to do that. But this came out on Friday morning, and I had the priests in my diocese saying, we've got masses on Saturday and Sunday. What do we do? Yeah. And again, they don't want to be disobedient. So I think there was some urgency there to try to address this.
Now, but if I may, though, what about a bishop who is disinclined to give these permissions, who says, look, the way I read it, the motu proprio is actually asking us bishops to move on from the traditional Latin Mass, to move towards a more, to a single rite. And maybe even that bishop will be among those who say, no, I've had trouble in my diocese with this. And, you know, so I'm going to give that bishop the benefit of the doubt, I suppose. But if the bishop is disinclined to give a dispensation as you've given, or to give in a more informal way, just a general permission to just keep doing what you're doing until I study this more, is it the case that in that diocese, really, the traditional Latin Mass could all but disappear?
Yes, that is a possibility, and I think that's the biggest impact of this motu proprio. I think the main point of the motu proprio is our Holy Father is basically telling bishops, now this is up to you. And that's the main difference between his motu proprio and the document issued by Pope Benedict XVI, Summorum Pontificum, which basically was on papal authority telling priests that you go ahead and celebrate Mass in the terminology that he used, the ordinary, extraordinary form. The biggest change here is the letter that Pope Benedict issued accompanying his document was saying that he was doing this in a sense to spare bishops from having to deal with requests on a daily, almost daily basis about whether or not to approve the masses according to the 1962 Missal. Pope Francis taking the other approach of saying that the bishops should have oversight over this in their diocese. So he's basically telling us bishops that it's up to you to regulate this. So on the one hand, I would say that does seem to give the authority to a bishop to say that I just don't want this in my diocese anymore. On the other hand, I don't think that's even the spirit of what Pope Francis is calling for here. I think he wants there to see one form eventually, but I don't think he's calling for that right away. I've tried to calm some people's fears in terms of what the document says by pointing out what it doesn't say. It does not suppress the Missal of 1962. Right. It doesn't say that all of these parish communities have to be suppressed or abolished. In fact, the Pope clearly says in Article 3, Paragraph 5, to proceed suitably to verify that the parishes canonically erected for the benefit of these faithful are effective for their spiritual growth, and to determine whether or not to retain them. So we clearly have the authority to retain these. So I think any bishop who is pastorally sensitive to the needs of his people, even if he personally does not care for the traditional Latin Mass, you've got people in your parishes and your dioceses that do find spiritual nourishment in this. And in that regard, I think the reality is, even in the ordinary form, if you go from one parish to another, you might find one parish where their Mass is more of a folk style with guitars and drums and different musical instruments. And you go to another parish, again, in the ordinary form, where you've got organ music and Gregorian chant, possibly even the Mass being said in Latin in the ordinary form. So, I mean, we already have different styles, and people have different tastes and what nourishes them spiritually. So I think just being pastorally sensitive in those cases where people are attracted to the Mass according to the 1962 Missal, to allow that to continue.
One of the signs that people have been attracted to it has been the growth of the FSSP, the Society of St. Peter, the Fraternal Society of St. Peter, and or the Priestly Society of St. Peter, I think. And I want to ask you about that when we come back, because they have seminaries in formation. What happens to those seminarians? Because they have a load of seminarians, as a matter of fact. Can they open new parishes? Or, I've already told us you're able to give a dispensation for parishes that are already there, but what's the future as far as new parishes? And you said you want to bring some peace to people, so I'll let you do that a little bit more. I want to ask you about your comments at the recent Napa Institute in reference to St. Thomas More and how he handled similar situations. We'll do all of that when we come back with our guest, Bishop Thomas Paprocki, right after this.
Catholic Answers Live.
Hi, this is Cy Kellett. Don't forget to check out the latest episode of our podcast, Catholic Answers Focus. You can listen each week to the world's premier podcast on Catholic apologetics at CatholicAnswersFocus.com or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Catholic Answers Focus, now available at CatholicAnswersFocus.com.
Unplanned, the true story of Abby Johnson.
I would be the youngest director in Planned Parenthood history.
She believed in a woman's right to choose.
I've had an abortion myself, so I don't have any problem with another woman making the same decision.
Until the day she saw something that changed everything.
Tiny, perfect little baby. And then it was just gone.
Now she's pulling back the curtain on the abortion industry. Unplanned.
Available at EWTNRC.com and the EWTN app.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. Our guest second hour will be Tim Staples. He'll actually come join us later this hour because Bishop Paprocki has a very happy occasion, one that I know always make bishops happy. He's installing a new pastor, so we'll have to let him go a little bit early this hour. If you'd like to speak with Bishop Paprocki, we'll do our best to get some folks on with him, 888-318-7884. Of course, we're talking about the recent apostolic letter from Pope Francis regarding the celebration of the tradition Latin Mass. Bishop Paprocki has chosen to give a dispensation to some parishes in his diocese, something that is within the power of a bishop to do on disciplinary matters. And so he has done that. And maybe that's an option for some other bishops who might like to follow that. But Bishop, a couple things to ask you. Oh, by the way, did I give out the number? 888-318-7884. If you want to talk with Bishop Paprocki, we'll try to get you on before he has to go and install a pastor. 888-318-7884. All right, seminarians and new parishes I want to ask you about, Bishop. It seems to me that last I heard, the FSSP priests have scores of young men in preparation for the priesthood. That would suggest that they are growing, and so you need a place for those priests to minister, which would mean at some point they would need new parishes. But is the ordination of new priests who will celebrate the traditional Latin Mass possible, and are new parishes possible?
Well, I would say, first of all, in terms of ordaining priests, what the motu proprio says in Article 4 is priests ordained after the publication of the present motu proprio who wish to celebrate using the Missale Romanum of 1962 should submit a formal request to the diocesan bishop. Now, as a canonist, I like to point out and look for differences between shoulds and shalls. I take shoulds to be more of an encouragement to do something or strong recommendation. A shall is more prescriptive. And so it says such newly ordained priest should submit a formal request to the diocesan bishop who shall consult with the apostolic see. So apparently bishop is required to have that consultation. A priest should consult or ask the bishop. I'm not sure what happens if he doesn't. There doesn't state any penalty here. But it's interesting, says when it says the bishop shall consult the apostolic see before granting this authorization. Clearly, it's the bishop that grants the authorization. And the motu proprio does not say that the bishop needs permission or approval. It just says consult. So normally in the canonical world, you consult, and when somebody gives you advice, you should take that advice unless you have reasons to the contrary. And so if someone is being ordained for a group that they're part of their charism, or the main focus of their charism is the Mass according to the 1962 Missal, I think that's a very grave reason. But also there's another article here that says Institutes of Consecrated Life and Society of Apostolic Life fall under the competence of the Congregation for Institutes of Consecrated Life and Societies of Apostolic Life. That's Article 6. And the Priestly Fraternity of St. Peter is it's a Society of Apostolic Life, pontifical right. So it would seem to me that that would fall under that congregation. And so they would have jurisdiction over those priests. But again, if they, unless they're going to suppress that community, which does not seem to be indicated anywhere here, it would seem to me that that permission should be and would be given to such newly ordained priests.
Again, Bishop Thomas Papraki is our guest. He's the Bishop of Springfield, Illinois, who has dispensed several parishes in his diocese to continue provide the traditional Latin Mass. You're welcome to call with your questions. 888-318-7884 is our number. So it listening to you talk about it, Bishop, you do have a kind of irenic attitude towards it. It seems that the Pope has left, and really, I mean, he's got plenty of canon lawyers, so he didn't have to, I suppose. He could have done other things. It seems like he's left enough doors so that the bishop who is open to the traditional Latin Mass, he can provide that and see that it's provided in his diocese with no problem.
Yes, I think so. You know, I think it's a question of how you look at this and interpret it. So I was on a panel discussion last Friday at the Napa Institute, their annual conference in California, and I was asked to be part of a panel with some other bishops. And the approach I tried to take was to calm people's fears a little bit about all this. And I referred to the fact that my name is Thomas John. I was baptized after these two martyrs, and my patron saints, Thomas More and John Fisher. And so particularly with legal matters, I try to look to Thomas More. And the example, and the Office of Readings for their feast day on June 22nd, there's a letter from Thomas More to his daughter, Margaret. And he says something to the effect that he's very grateful to the king. He's writing from prison. He's in the Tower of London after being in prison. He said, "I'm very grateful to the king because he's taking nothing away from me other than my liberty." So he had a way of trying to look at the positive of everything. And then also there's a scene in the movie A Man for All Seasons about the life of St. Thomas More. So I'm not sure if it's historically accurate, but it sounds like Thomas More. There's a scene where King Henry VIII has issued his act of supremacy, naming the king to be the head of the Church of England, and everyone in the kingdom is required to swear an oath to that act of supremacy. And his daughter Margaret comes rushing in the room, almost hysterical, that they're going to be required to take the oath. And Thomas More takes a very lawyerly approach. He says, well, an oath is made up of words. Let me read it and see what it says, and let me see if I can sign this oath. So he was trying to see, was there some wiggle room in this?
Yeah.
Now, in the end, as we know, there was not any discretion for him to sign it. He did not, and was beheaded because of that. But in this document, I think Pope Francis has given plenty of wiggle room in terms of bishops being able to look at the different provisions that that expressly allow for the Latin Mass community to be retained. I think there's some question in there about establishing new parishes, and the indication of the Holy Father seems to be not to have new parishes. But again, that doesn't forbid the establishment of a new community, which could be under a different canonical feature, like a shrine or an oratory. So a shrine is a sacred place where people come on a pilgrimage. And it's my experience that places like my diocese, which just has these Sunday masses in two parish churches, that people are coming from even sometimes outside the diocese to attend these masses. Or it could be an oratory. An oratory is a sacred place established for a particular community. So without establishing a personal parish, a bishop could establish an oratory similar to a church structure where these masses can be celebrated.
So for a community like, and there are several others, I'm sure, I think you have two others in your diocese, but I'm most familiar because we have them here in San Diego with the FSSP. For such a community, this is not a desperate situation. They'll have to find places where they're welcome and then they can be accommodated.
I would think so. I would think, even in a situation, if the bishop were to say, I thank you, but I don't want your presence in my diocese anymore celebrating these masses. Well, I'm sure they would be able to find another bishop somewhere else that would accept them.
I have noted, Bishop, in my reading about the kind of reaction articles that people have written, there does not seem to be a great deal of support for what the Pope has done. It seems there's kind of a general chorus of, I don't know why he did it. I mean, the nicest things are people who say, well, his concern about the rejection of the Second Vatican Council is valid, but I don't see the connection between these two things. So this is the nice ones. I wonder if you share my impression of how this motu proprio is being received.
Yes, I wonder myself about the timing of this and why this came out now. It seems to me that, at least in my experience and in my diocese, things were fairly quiet about this. Only a handful of parishes where the Mass is being celebrated in the extraordinary form in Latin. And in those parishes, it's been my experience that people are not questioning the validity of the Novus Ordo. They're not questioning the validity of the Second Vatican Council. But now it seems it's almost like stirred things up, and now you've got people that are very agitated about this. And so rather than kind of calming things down, I think it's kind of stirred a hornet's nest here. I would also make this distinction. There are people for sure that question the effectiveness of the Second Vatican Council, and not just those involved with the traditional Latin Mass. I think anyone who kind of looks realistically at what has happened in the church since the Second Vatican Council has to wonder about whether or not it succeeded in what it set out to do. A good example of that is a book by a sociologist in England, Stephen Bullivant. He teaches sociology at St. Mary's University in London, and he wrote a book called Mass Exodus. It's a study, a sociological study of the church in the United Kingdom and in the United States since the Second Vatican Council. And it's a very statistical analysis and basically says if the objective of the Second Vatican Council was to increase participation in the life of the church and increase vocations of the priesthood and religious life, it didn't do that. And in fact, quite the opposite. We saw a dramatic decrease in the number of people attending Sunday Mass and the number of vocations to priesthood and religious life. So he concludes in that sense that Vatican II failed in its objective. Now, that's to say that something failed does not mean that it was invalid. You read the documents of the Second Vatican Council, and they're very beautiful documents. The failure is in the implementation. We have a long way to go in terms of reanimating Catholic life in our parishes and our dioceses around the world. But that's not a rejection of Vatican II. It's just saying we need to do a better job of implementing it.
Bishop Thomas Papraki from Springfield, Illinois, our guest. We'll go straight to calls for the bishop when we come back. And as I said, then the bishop has to get on to installing a pastor. So we'll have Tim finish out this hour and lead us through the entire next hour with open forum. And if you want to stay on the line, if you've got questions about the Latin Mass for Tim, that's fine as well. Right back after this.
Catholic Answers Live.
Here's a question. Is it really possible to be friends with someone who died 2,000 years ago? Maybe the problem is that we've grown way too comfortable with the story of Jesus. Nice man, right? Taught us to love one another, said not to judge people. We celebrate his birthday every year. It's time to put away this small, safe version of Jesus, says Cy Kellett. Nobody that bland could have transformed the world. In A Teacher of Strange Things, Cy presents Jesus Christ undiluted by sentiment, with all his radical words and deeds uncensored. Do you know someone, your son or daughter perhaps, or maybe your mom or dad, who needs the friendship of Jesus Christ? Do you? Order your copy of A Teacher of Strange Things by visiting shop.catholic.com today or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Catholic Answers is doing it again. We're holding our 7th annual Apologetics Conference this September in beautiful San Diego, California, and we'd like to see you there. Join us September 23rd to 26th for a lively and inspiring conference with an all-star lineup of speakers guaranteed to jumpstart your faith. It's a great chance to meet all your favorite Catholic Answers apologists and very special guests as we spend 4 days talking about worshiping and adoring our Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ. This is where it all begins. Don't miss what promises to be the event of the season. Join us this September for a conference that is sure to ignite, inspire, and inform your faith. Seats are still available, but they're going fast. Visit CatholicAnswersConference.com or call 888-291-8000 to register.
There are times when we get angry.
It's how we respond that matters.
How do you deal with anger?
Share it tomorrow on Take Two with Jerry and Debbie on most of these EWTN stations.
Now back to Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. A special treat for us today to get to talk with Bishop Thomas Papraki, the Bishop of Springfield, Illinois, and also a canon lawyer, very familiar with the canons, the laws of the Catholic Church, and did something that no other bishop has done yet, as far as I know, in the United States, but perhaps is a way forward, that is issued dispensations for certain parishes to continue in their offering of the traditional Latin Mass. Now it's time for your calls for Bishop Papraki, because I've been talking with him a lot, and we've got him for a little while longer, so let's see if we can get some callers on. John in Columbus, Ohio, listening on the new and improved Catholic Answers Live app. Go ahead, John, with your question for Bishop Papraki. John?
I'm wondering what was meant when the motu proprio said parochial parishes. Like, what all does that entail?
The reference, actually, Article 3, Paragraph 2, is parochial churches. So the distinction between a church and a parish. So a parish is usually a territory, although it doesn't have to be. And so a Latin Mass community, for example, can be set up as a personal parish, like a military archdiocese is a personal archdiocese. It's not bounded by any particular territory. The reference is to parochial church, and parochial is the adjective that refers to parish. You could also say a parish church. So when it says not in parochial churches, that would mean there are churches that are not attached to a parish. But the language here is referring to churches that are attached to a parish. I'd also make a comment about the language. I mean, there's another thing that's a little different here is that normally canonical documents or documents with canonical effect, they're issued with the official language being in Latin, and then the other modern languages are translations. But if there's ever a question about the meaning of a word, you have to go back to the Latin to see what it says. Well, there is no Latin text of this document, despite the fact that the title is in Latin, Traditionis Custodes, that's Latin. The guardians of the tradition is the way it's translated in English. But the English translation issued by the Vatican says it's an official translation. Now, the Italian apparently is the original language, but if we have an official translation in English, I would say we can go with the English translation. For example, in Article 1, it says that the liturgical books promulgated by Popes St. Paul VI and John Paul II are the unique expression of the Lex Orandi of the Roman Church. In other words, the way of praying of the Roman Rite. Well, and that's different. The Italian is la unica espressione, and unica in Italian is more like only, the only expression, whereas in English it says unique, and unique has a very different connotation, like you and I are unique human beings, but we're not the only human beings on the earth. So in this sense, I would say, yes, this is the Novus Ordo is a unique expression. Of the Roman Rite, but it's not necessarily the only one.
John, thanks. I hope that was helpful to you. I'm going to keep moving because I'd like to get as many on with Bishop Paprocki as we can. Tom in Stanford, Connecticut, listening on EWTN Radio. Tom, you are up. Go ahead with your question for Bishop Thomas Paprocki.
Great. Thank you, Your Excellency. I have two observations. I appreciate your commentary on. The first is, most of the commentators, I've read quite a few of them, on the motu proprio, seem to really be dancing around what I see as the main thrust of the document, of the motu proprio, combined with the letter, which is to end the traditional Latin Mass. I mean, he has language in there concluding, you know, abrogating everything that comes before, and also language about, and essentially I'm going to paraphrase, but until we get everybody switched over to Novus Ordo. So my first observation, which I'd like your comment, appreciate your commentary on, is on that general thrust, which to my reading is to end the practice of TLM.
Okay.
And the Tom,
I'm going to let him, the bishop, answer that one because there are so many people on the line. Let's see if we can, how long that takes, and then we'll make a decision if we're coming back. Bishop, it does seem that the Pope is saying, at least in the long term, maybe even in the medium term, he expects the traditional Latin Mass to end. Is that correct?
I would say yes. He would like there to see just one form rather than the two forms that we have now in the Roman Rite. But I would say that was also Pope Benedict's objective. He I think, foresaw going about it in a different way. Pope Benedict set up sort of parallel tracks when he used the terminology, the ordinary form and the extraordinary form, and these parallel tracks. I think he foresaw that someday in the future a pope would bring those two tracks together, perhaps merging the best of both forms. I think Pope Francis also would like there to be one form, but with a sense that maybe the extraordinary form will go away. There also seems to be a sense that people attached to the extraordinary form are older folks that are nostalgic for the Second Vatican Council. That has not been my experience. Most people who grew up with the Second Vatican Council have moved on, and they're not looking back. It's surprisingly, it's actually young people that they discover the extraordinary form and they seem very attached to it.
So that being the case, Bishop, is there any chance that some of the things that young people are finding in the traditional Latin Mass could just be incorporated into the celebration of the what we call the Novus Ordo Mass, the ordinary form of the Mass?
Yes.
Do you think there is?
I hear sometimes, you know, the people who go to the extraordinary form, are they really looking for the extraordinary rite that's being used there? Or are they looking for more the the trappings or the accoutrements with it. So, you know, if you do Mass in the, let's say you're doing Mass, as I used to when I was Chancellor of the Archdiocese of Chicago, I said Mass once a month at St. John Cantius Church in Chicago. So Mass is in Latin, in a very traditional sacred architecture. You've got your Gregorian chant, your Ad Orientem, you're using incense. I think a lot of those things are the more the style of the worship that people are looking for, rather than, you know, if it's in Latin, if the, I wonder sometimes if they even would know the difference between, other than some of the obvious things like the prayers at the foot of the altar, but so much of the rest, it's in Latin. And they don't know Latin, are they even aware of what the differences are?
Tom, I'm going to keep moving because I got to. There are a bunch of folks on. Jim in South Dakota listening on Real Presence Radio. Go ahead, Jim, with your question for Bishop Thomas Paprocki.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. See, the documents with the motu proprio had referred to a survey that was sent out, and I'd heard about the survey, but I'd never actually seen any sort of the results of the survey. So I was hoping that the bishop could elaborate on what that survey was and if he knew of any of the results of that survey.
Yeah, the results of the survey have not been published. I've just heard sort of through the grapevine, the typical unnamed Vatican source said something like about 30% of the world's bishops responded. And of those 30%, it was about evenly split half and half between those who were in favor and those who were opposed to it. I have to admit, I did not see the survey myself. It was sent out to the bishops on the USCCB website for bishops with a lot of other documents in April of last year when we were in the midst of churches being closed with the pandemic and all that. So it just didn't catch my attention, and there was no separate mailing or no email that came to the bishops to call it to our attention. So I wonder how many bishops like myself just missed it and therefore didn't respond.
I think making a little bit of news there, Bishop. Jim, I'm very grateful for the question. That would mean if your unnamed Vatican source was accurate, about 15% of the world's bishops responded with negativity towards the traditional Latin Mass.
That would seem to be, if that quote is accurate, that would seem to be what the result was.
Jim, again, thank you for that very helpful question. I got to go to Ohio now. Sounds like it's a bad thing. There's nothing wrong with going to Ohio. Adam, listening on 9:10 a.m. in Ohio. You're up next, Adam. Go ahead with your question for Bishop Paprocki.
Hi there. I just thought, just listening to the conversations, and it's very ingenious and very, very civil, but it almost seems to me this motu proprio almost kind of negates Vatican II. You look at the context of the beautiful documents that our eminence has said, and how the documents didn't name the execution went right. But nonetheless, by kind of restricting the Latin Mass, which I don't attend at all. I kind of favor toward the east side of things, like Greek and Aramaic.
Your concern is, but, Adam, I just got to, because I know I'm going to lose the bishop here in a couple minutes.
Go ahead.
So your point being, though, does this motu proprio negate some of the Second Vatican Council's work? Is that the basic question?
Yes, sir. You've got it. And your prosecutor did well.
Okay, great. Bishop, does it?
Well, I'm not sure exactly what he means by negated. I think that if one of the thrusts of the Second Vatican Council by putting Mass in the vernacular was to make it more widely accessible, but also to allow for a certain diversity in there, that that does raise that question, because if the goal here is that there's some discomfort with having the two different forms within the Roman Rite, and we should just have one way of saying Mass. Well, we have a number of different rites already in the Church, even here in the United States, where I was in the Archdiocese of Chicago. There's the Ukrainian Catholic Church, there's the Syro-Malabar Church. I mean, we have different Catholic rites within the Catholic Church. And then, as I was saying earlier, we also have different liturgical styles, even within the Novus Ordo, with the ordinary form. So in that sense, I'm not sure exactly what the objective here of the motu proprio would be in trying to suppress the extraordinary form.
Adam, I'm going to go back to you just because that was a very important question. Does that make sense to you, what the bishop said?
Yes, it does. It really does.
Okay, great. I'm thank you very much for the question. Do you have to go, Bishop, or can we get one more question in, do you think?
We can get another one in yet.
All right.
We're good.
And caller, you got to be quick with your question. The bishop really is on a tight time schedule. Carol in Minnesota, listening on EWTN, you are up next. Can you be quick with your question for the bishop?
Hi. Well, my question is wishful thinking. I'm 78 years old, and I was 20 when Vatican II happened. And back then, it was so drastic and such a disaster that, and so difficult for people, that I'm wondering if there's a chance that perhaps they'll revisit Vatican II, because everything that it did, the vestments, the very architecture of the church, the missals, the choirs that had sung Latin. I was from a big Chicago historical parish, St. Thomas Apostle there, and suddenly that marvelous altar was transformed into basically a card table facing the people, you know?
Okay, I'm going to let the bishop comment on that, because the basic thrust there, Bishop, you get the basic thrust, but can the Second Vatican Council be revisited?
Well, I think when we talk about the Second Vatican Council, we have to be more precise exactly what we're talking about, because I think a lot of things were done in the so-called spirit of the Second Vatican Council that you won't find anywhere in the documents. For example, they're in the use of Latin language is not suppressed in the Second Vatican Council. In fact, it encourages its continued use. It allows for Mass in the vernacular, but it does not say that we should stop saying Mass in Latin. Nowhere does it say that we should stop using Gregorian chant. In fact, it encourages Gregorian chant. Nowhere does it say that we should stop using Roman vestments. So a lot of things there that I think we actually go back and read the documents, you'll find there's a lot of very good, rich tradition in the documents if we would actually read them.
Carol, thank you so much. And I think your experience is shared by many. A lot of people got carried away at the parish level and all kinds of crazy things happened. It does seem that we're moving in a better direction now, especially with bishops like Bishop Thomas Papraki of Springfield, Illinois. Bishop, I know you got to go to install a pastor. May we have your blessing before you go?
Yes, well, let's pray. Dear God, we ask you to send your blessings upon all those who are listening or watching this program, that our words that we have shared may help them, inspire them, and lift them up. And may Almighty God bless you, the Father, and the Son, and the Holy Spirit.
Amen. Bishop Thomas Papraki of Springfield, Illinois, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Right back after this.
There's only one Catholic Answers Live.
Do you love praying for people? Have you ever wanted to use your gift of prayer to share Jesus with others and build up the body of Christ? Start a public prayer station with St. Paul Street Evangelization. Listen to people's needs, pray with them, or invite them to meet you at church. St. Paul Street Evangelization can help you get started. Find out how at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects home buyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
He was a scholar, a preacher, a Capuchin Franciscan, and a defender of Christendom.
Matthew Bunsen and the Doctors of the Church.
St. Lawrence of Brindisi was one of the most respected preachers in the 17th century, but he also helped raise an army against the Ottoman Turks when they invaded Hungary in 1601. He led the troops to victory against the Turks, carrying only a crucifix. He was declared a Doctor of the Church in 1959.
For more about the Doctors of the Church, visit doctorsofthechurch.com.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. We're moving on to Open Forum with Tim Staples. Tim, thanks for coming in.
Hey, good to be with you, my friend.
Tim, of course, the author of Behold Your Mother, A Biblical and Historical Defense of the Marian Doctrines, and also possibly the greatest Catholic apologist in this studio right now. No, in the world today. That's what I want to say. Tim, thanks for coming in and doing this.
Hey, I don't appreciate you putting me here after Bishop Papraki leaves, as if I have to fill his shoes, because his shoes are too big for me.
Yeah, but you got the blessing, though, by
yes,
getting
I did.
Here. So you got the Episcopal blessing. I am embarrassed to do this, but I have to read something which is very flattering to myself.
Okay,
but it's an ad, so I have to read it, Tim, before I can go to the phones.
It's okay. You can go to confession later.
Okay. Okay, so this is what I was stunned by this. Somebody wrote this a comment on my book, A Teacher of Strange Things. I have been a Christian all my life. This is Lisa, by the way. So I didn't think that this book would offer me anything new or beneficial. Boy, was I wrong. Things I have never really been able to wrap my brain around, Cy explained with such simplicity that I wondered how I missed them. I should have had you read this. This would have sounded so much better coming from you. And what else I need to learn. I was humbled by this book and have plenty of highlights to go back to.
Wow.
I have recommended this book to lots of friends. It's also the perfect book for someone who doesn't know anything about Jesus, which is what it was meant for, and that meant so much to me, Lisa, to read that. And I had to read it because you can get 2-for-1 right now at shop.catholic.com. A Teacher of Strange Things, Who Jesus Was, What He Taught, and Why People Still Follow Him. It's 2-for-1 right now. So especially for that parent who has the adult child who doesn't know Jesus, maybe a copy for yourself and a copy for the child at shop.catholic.com. Tim, ready to go to the phones?
I am ready.
Colm in Dublin, Ireland, the fastest growing city in the world. Do you know that old joke?
I don't.
It's Dublin every year. Listening on EWN.
I have been to Dublin.
Have you been to Dublin? No, I've never been to Dublin. No.
I love Dublin. I just love Ireland. I tell you, actually getting outside of Dublin, though, and getting out in the country, man, there's nothing like it. It's beautiful.
As good as Virginia?
Almost.
All right. Colm, go ahead with your question for Tim.
Well, I just wanted to, I was going to comment on the coronavirus, but I was going to comment on the liturgy, too. I think the new version of the English is totally unnecessary. I went through the Eucharistic prayer number one of the 1974 version, and there was nothing doctrinally wrong or incomprehensible about any of it. So I think that the new version is verbose, and it's nearly worse than it sabotages the Mass.
Colm, you have me, maybe not Tim, but me. I feel at a little bit of a disadvantage. Is that the Mass prayers for Great Britain? Do you have your own?
No, that would be the English translation 2012.
That's, for the world.
That's the final. The latest revision up until now and during the reign of Pope Benedict XVI.
Oh, I've got you. Okay, so.
And I think, Colm, there was a reason behind that translation. Now, I would respectfully disagree with you on this point. I believe what Pope Benedict did, and it was really, it was begun by Pope St. John Paul the Great, because the translation of 74 was more of a dynamic translation. And I always say I love Pope St. Paul VI, but I think that was a mistake. The one thing I just wish he wouldn't have done was he gave the approval for that dynamic translation. And that's what gave us some problems in the liturgy. You know, famously, for example, the fourth Eucharistic prayer, which said, the translation anyway, basically said, Father, you alone are the one God living and true, which is actually not correct. He alone is not the only God living and true, because there's two other persons that are also God living and true. So also you had some translations that were somewhat nebulous. We're not, you know, it needed, I think pretty much everybody understood that we needed some revision. And for example, in the Creed, one in being with the Father, instead of now what we have, consubstantialis, right? Consubstantial. Because that really brings out the idea of same nature, that Christ in the incarnation has the same nature as the Father and the same nature as Mary, right? The divine nature and the human nature. But when you say one in being, it really makes it nebulous to the point of one in being. What is that, right? It doesn't really get at what the Latin actually said, consubstantialis. And so that's just a couple off the top of my head. And so the idea was to bring the translation back to a more literal translation of what the Latin text actually says. And I tell you, when I pray the Mass, I see in many different instances how the new translation is better. It's more theologically accurate and rich. But, you know, I get your point. You know, it may be that you get used to a dynamic translation and then one comes in that's more literal. It might be a little bit shocking.
Jarring, yeah.
A little jarring. Yeah, it's a good word to use. But, you know, thanks be to God, Holy Mother Church has our best interest in mind. And I do believe the popes are moving us forward liturgically with better translations and more teaching that goes along with it. I think Pope St. John Paul, Pope Benedict XVI, the teaching has been really phenomenal over the decades. And I do believe we are moving forward.
Does that satisfy you, Colum?
Well, I would respectfully disagree, and I find it verbose, and I found the old wording far, as I said, there was nothing doctrinally wrong.
Oh, sure there was. I just gave you two examples where there were problems, and I could give you more. You know what I'd appreciate, though, is maybe you could call back or maybe even write us at Catholic.com, because I would love to see some examples of where the new translation is lacking, because that I have not seen. I think for the most part, the changes in the translation were outstanding and have led to a more accurate translation of both the liturgy and even some of the biblical texts as well.
Colin, this is one of those ones, though, that I, you know, that we can disagree with one another on. We're very grateful for the very respectful disagreement. If you want to send us an email, radio@catholic.com, we'll make sure it gets where it needs to go, radio@catholic.com. And I really don't care what an Irish guy is saying. I just like listening to the Irish guy talk. I don't think I was even paying attention that much. I was just, but yeah. You talked about the doctrinal ones. I have to say, for me, my favorite change is, Lord, I am not worthy for you to enter under my roof.
Yes.
Because you feel you're directly connected to the gospel passage.
That's right.
In a way. I can't even remember what the old translation was. Lord, I'm not worthy that you should. I can't even remember what it was.
It comes right from, I think it's Matthew chapter 8, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, it is beautiful. And when you do that, it really, it's getting back to the Latin text, right?
Right.
And getting back to, in this case, the text of Scripture as well, that, you know, there is a certain sense in which we say that it's the Latin text that is the official translation of the Mass, right? So the 1970 Missal, which has been revised several times, coupled by John Paul and finally by Benedict in 2012, when it comes to the liturgy, there are little revisions here and there, but the Latin hasn't changed.
No, right,
you know,
right.
We're really getting back to what the Latin is, and the Latin is really beautiful.
And the other thing Colin probably doesn't experience in Ireland, but we do here, is now the Spanish and English translations are much closer to one another, so that if you go to Mass in English and Spanish, it's not like, what? These are two really different things.
That's a good point. And I should mention, the couple that I pointed out before had nothing to do with the Latin text. It was bad translations into English.
Call him again. Thanks very much. We're going to next hour. We're going to continue with open forum. So if you're on the line, stay on the line. If you haven't called yet, you're welcome to call 888-318-7884. Tim Staples is going to stay right here. We're not going to let him go. And he'll be answering your questions, whatever they are. And whether you're Catholic or not, 888-318-7884.